No matter where you go in the world, there's a general denominator that binds men. An example happened on my first night ever in Manila. Sitting at a street-facing bar with rows of tables and single men, all just having a beer and watching females, I wasn't ready to succumb to jet lag and decided to stay out till midnight. And then it happened. I got chatting to the guy next to me, who happened to be from Munich. The subject got onto football, and before we knew it, we had a table of five other guys, all from different countries, all chatting football. It is the world's favourite sport, and brings men together like nothing else. Hi, and welcome back to the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I'm Steve, your host. The English like to think they invented football, and when it comes to organised football, this is true. But football had been around for a very long time. Indeed, the world's oldest football was found in the rafters of Stirling Castle in Scotland during restoration work in 1981. Carbon dating put this ball to the 1540s when Mary, Queen of Scots, was in residence. She had recorded in her diary of the court playing both football and an early form of golf. And you can see the picture of this ball on my Twitter page, the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. And today's shout out is from one football fan to another. American Mark from Maryland, a big Spurs fan. This episode's for you. On the 16th of November, 2022, Brentford and England forward Ivan Toney was charged by the English Football Association of 232 breaches of its gambling laws, and he was subsequently banned from professional football for 8 months. To make it clear, professional footballers are not allowed to bet on the outcome of football matches, and it pretty much stems from the following two instances from English football. In 1915, Manchester United were playing Liverpool. Manchester United were battling relegation, and Liverpool were mid-table. Due to World War I, the Football League was due to be suspended at the end of the season, and some players perhaps seeing a long war and the end of their career, some of the players decided to fix the result and make some money from betting on it. Manchester United won 2-0, but fans and the referee had noted Liverpool's lack of commitment during the game. They had also missed a penalty. After the match, it became publicly known that large amounts of money had been bet at 7-1, on a 2-0 win for United. And for you non-gamblers, 7-1 means that if you bet £1,000, you would collect £7,000 plus your original stake back. The Football Association launched an investigation and found United players Sandy Turnbull, Arthur Whaley, Enoch West, and Liverpool players Jackie Shelton, Tom Miller, Bob Purcell, and Thomas Fairfield guilty. Sheldon was a former United player and the ringleader. Craig Pagnum was a United player and he knew about the plot and was against it, even almost scoring a goal, his header hitting the bar and caused several of the players to shout at him. He testified against the United players and all seven players were banned for life. It was deemed that officials from both clubs were oblivious to the scandal. Of the players, Sandy Turnbull was killed during the war, and the other players had their bans lifted due to the service for their country. But to look at why players, who are better paid than every other trade, would want to bet and risk their careers. We have to see the roots of it and look to the motives. When organised football began in the 1870s, it was an amateur game, and would only be in 1885 that the English FA sanctioned professional teams with the following criteria. It is in the interests of association football to legalise the employment of professional football players, but only under certain restrictions, and clubs were allowed to pay players provided they had either been born or lived for 2 years within a 6 mile radius of the ground. We see the example of a pay of a footballer when, in the 1895-96 season, William Folk of Sheffield United had his wages increased to £3 a week, which included a retainer wage over the summer. Folk and his teammates were also paid a 10 shilling or 50p bonus for an away win and 5 shillings for a home win or an away draw. Records show that for a key games, the players were paid £5 for a win. If we compare this, the average wage of a working man was about £1. After the First World War, professional footballers received a maximum weekly wage of £10. However, the following year it was reduced to £8 for a 37 weeks playing season and £6 for the 15 weeks close season. The maximum wage was increased to £14 in 1951, £15 in 1953, £17 in 1957, and £20 in 1958. And then we would see a slow explosion towards the vast wages modern players earn. The players made further wages demand in 1960, and when those were backed by a threat to strike, on the 14th of January 1961, the Football League responded by abolishing the maximum wage. Johnny Hayes, the England captain, became the first £100 per week player. When Kevin Keegan joined Liverpool from Scunthorpe in May 1971, Bill Shankly's first wage offer was £45 per week. In his autobiography, Keegan recalled, "I wanted to sign there and then, but remembered that my father had told me not to sell myself cheap." Keegan told Shankly he expected more than £45. Shankly replied, "That's upsetting. Don't forget, young man, we're paying £33,000 for you." Keegan's basic wage at Scunthorpe in the old 4th Division had been £30 a week, with an £8 win bonus and £4 draw bonus. Keegan and Shankly eventually settled on a starting wage of £50 a week at Liverpool. Regular first team football, appearance money and win bonuses added £80 a week to that basic figure. Figures cited in the official history of the PFA showed that only 8 players in England earned basic salaries of £50,000 per year in 1980-81. But this rose to 41 players by 1984-85 and steadily thereafter. And the floodgates are well and truly open, with Liverpool's Mo Salah earning £400,000 a week plus bonuses, not to mention new Saudi money, which has been buying players left, right and centre and paying disproportionate wages, with Cristiano Ronaldo's reported £3 million a week basic salary, tax-free. Nice job for kicking a round ball. But it's back to the 1960s we go for our second match-fixing scandal. Scotsman Jimmy Gold was born in Aberdeen in 1931. He was, which would be described, as a journeyman footballer, and he played for many clubs in Scotland, Ireland and England. At 29, whilst playing for Mansfield Town, he broke his leg, which finished his playing career. The year prior to his career-ending injury, he'd been part of a Swindon team that suffered an adverse result against Port Vale, resulting in a club that was going to renew his contract, releasing him after a board meeting amid accusations of unproved match-fixing. Gold then decided to start using the contacts he'd made in the game to start making some money. In 1962, he got in touch with former Swindon teammate David Payne, currently at top division Sheffield Wednesday. They identified a game against reigning champions Ipswich, who, despite having only won 3 of their first 19 games of the season, were a talented team, capable of beating anyone. Lane then spoke to 2 Sheffield Wednesday players, England internationals Peter Swan and Tony Kay, and convinced them to join in. After all, they were mid-table and didn't look like competing for the championship or being relegated. Gold also agreed to cover the other players' £50 stakes, and they all bet on an Ipswich win, which was duly obliged with a 2-0 win. The £50 stakes, however, had been on accumulators, which required other results to be in their favour. They had Brentford to beat Lincoln, which ended 3-1, and Oldham to beat York 3-2. All results came in. They went to collect, but the bookmakers were suspicious, and due to the processes, Gould sent only half of the £900 for the Wednesday players to Lane, and the other team's players also received less. But Gold had made a hefty profit for himself. He then waited, and it wasn't till the next year he would try again. Bradford Park Rovers and Bristol Rovers was the targeted game, and Edmund Million and Keith Williams were contacted by a friend of Gold, Mansfield's Brian Phillips. They agreed. However, the game ended 2-2. By now, suspicions of a match-fixing syndicate were flooding behind the scenes at the newspapers, and they got their breakthrough a few months later when Ken Thompson of Hartlepool United confessed in a Sunday People newspaper article that he had bet in a syndicate. The following Sunday, Gold was named as the masterminds behind a bribes ring. It stunned the whole of the UK's football fans, who saw the integrity of their beloved game tarnished. They wanted blood. Gould knew his game was up, and he sold his story to the Sunday People for £7,000, or £150,000 in today's money. He incriminated many footballers, resulting in 10 current or former players being sent for trial at Nottingham Assizes in 1965. And it was also the first time taped evidence was used in English court, and Gold's confession led to the following sentences. Gold, 4 years. Brian Phillips, 15 months. Jack Fountain, 15 months. Dick Beattie of St Mirren, a Scottish team, 9 months. Sammy Chapman, Ron Howells, Ken Thompson, 6 months. The Sheffield Wednesday players David Lane, Tony Kay and Peter Swan, all 4 months. All players were banned for life from professional football, which for England internationals Swan and Kay would be double punishment, as England would go on to win the World Cup the following year. In total, 33 players were prosecuted. It was estimated that Gold earned over £3,000 from the syndicate in addition to selling his story. On his release from prison, Gold would go and live in London, working as a security guard. He died at St Mary's Hospital in 2004, aged 75. Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you did, please like, subscribe, tell your friends, and to the next episode. Bye-bye.